you're never going to get a good deal. You're going to be a serf. You're going to be subjugated forever if we trend towards an authoritarian government. We want a government of the people. And that's what the framers had in mind. And it really matters. It's not just an abstraction.
Going forward, we need to recognize that a politics of inclusion, positivity, and abundance, if it can allow a blind Iranian-American to win statewide, then there's much more that we can do throughout the country.
Hi, and welcome to Amicus. This is Slate's podcast about the law and the Supreme Court and the rule of law. I am Dahlia Lithwick. I cover those things for Slate, and you would be forgiven if this weekend you are feeling a bit as though all those things are just a blur in the window of a speeding train. But that's why we're here. Later on in the show, we will talk to Cyrus Habib. He is the lieutenant governor of Washington State, and we're going to hear from him about reasons, believe it or not, to be optimistic about the law and the Constitution in October of 2019. But our first guest this week is one of several very prominent conservative lawyers who have helped form a coalition seeking to check what they deem illegal and unconstitutional behavior by the president. That group, called Checks and Balances, recently issued a statement calling for, quote, an expeditious impeachment probe into President Trump. This week, the president obliged by calling folks like them and other never-Trumpers, quote, human scum. Stuart Gerson was also on the winning side this past month of a big lawsuit challenging the president's authority to build a border wall, and we wanted to talk to him about that as well. Stuart served as Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Division of the Department of Justice from 1989 to 1993 and as Acting Attorney General for the Clinton administration in 1993, a job he took over from one William Barr. He's a member of the firm at Epstein Becker Green. He is also, as I said, a founding member of Checks and Balances. And as I noted at the top, he is also one of the lawyers who obtained a court ruling just a few weeks back in which a federal judge found that President Trump's proclamation of a national emergency along the southern border violated federal law because it illegally sought to override Congress's decision to not fund further border wall construction. So we wanted an update from him on that litigation and to generally have a check-in on the Trump resistance within the conservative legal community. So Stuart Gerson, welcome back to Amicus.
Well, to paraphrase the president, greetings from the bottom of the pond. It's nice to speak with you again, Dahlia.
And maybe we should start there. Your colleague in arms at Checks and Balances, Paul Rosenzweig, did write a pretty bracing piece in The Atlantic celebrating having been called scum. I wonder, this is not funny. We laugh about it, but it is actually not a funny thing when the president is calling some of the foremost legal minds. You've all given service to this country, worked so hard within the Federalist Society and within the conservative legal edifice to be called scum and to be called lowlifes. And I want to give you a chance to respond because I think it's easy to laugh it off, but it's actually not all that funny.
Well, to an intelligent and informed person, the appellation says more about the speaker than it does about the subjects. And all of us are people who I believe served with, if not distinction, at least general approbation. None of us is looking for a job. We believe in the Constitution. We're expressing traditional and fundamentally conservative, not just values, but principles with in terms of the way that we see the Constitution and we see the law. Unfortunately, we have an administration that sees things a bit differently. When you resort to the kind of invective that we see, I think it suggests to anybody who's intelligent that you have no force, no intellectual force, no substantive force behind any of the arguments here that you're making, and you're just name-calling. Now, to satisfy the educated is one thing. There's a mass out there that's called the president's base that unfortunately is relatively uninformed. If this has resonance with them, well, that's sad. We in Checks and Balances and elsewhere are trying to get enough out there in terms of reasoned views as to why we believe what we believe. We believe that still we're children of the American Revolution. We're people who are against authoritarianism. We don't have to take up arms. Our arms are the pen and the word. And as I say, if you name call, you're suggesting that you don't have the horsepower to confront us directly.
Let's talk about your lawsuit. We had you on when it was first filed. This is a separate suit from the California challenge to the border wall. This is a suit that it's an amazing coalition of co-counsel has come together on behalf of El Paso County in Texas and the Border Network for Human Rights. Can you remind us about what your lawsuit is and how it differs from the other litigation in California?
We represent the county of El Paso, Texas, and a public interest group called the Border Network. They are directly affected by the president's proclamation, not just in terms of the fact that additions to a wall will be coming through the county itself, but they're affected right now in terms of reputational damage, people not wanting to risk doing business with them, economic damage because funds are about to be diverted from Fort Bliss, which is in El Paso. It's the economic heart of that community. And the Border Network, which is an organization which under normal circumstances is a lobbying group that campaigns for humane immigration policies, has had to put aside its charter and it's become a counseling group dealing with people whose lives are disrupted now by the president's proclamation and fear of what's going on, which, of course, was greatly aggravated when a nutcase decided that he'd come from elsewhere into El Paso and commit murder. And so we were able to surmount the standing barrier with no disrespect intended to the plaintiffs in California who were talking about recreational injury and some other things. Our injury was pretty profound, and Judge Briones wrote at length about it and very responsibly so. He understood that we had testimony through affidavits and were prepared otherwise to present it from county and network officials talking about the immediate effect that the president's unlawful proclamation is having on them, was having on them, at least until the court's order.
Folks who were following these lawsuits noted in some dismay that in July, the Supreme Court stayed a ruling from a federal court in California that was blocking the border wall expressly in California and Arizona, expressly because the Supreme Court at least had, I think, some sympathy for this standing argument. So not only is your case differentiated from that because you think you have a stronger claim to standing, but I think what you're saying, and I just want to say it explicitly, is that that stronger claim to standing is going to hopefully what gets you, in your view, past the hurdle where the U.S. Supreme Court blocked this effort in California. Is that what you're saying?
That's largely correct, but it's not the only thing. As I noted earlier, we also have different causes of action from what was abiding in California. For one thing, we've brought a claim under the Administrative Procedure Act. The claim that we won under with respect to the Consolidated Appropriations Act is different from what was being argued in California. Of course, it has a constitutional base in Article 1. What the president has done here and what the court has found that the president has done is unlawfully divert monies from programs where Congress has specifically appropriated things having to do with the military housing, base development, things that affect the well-being of military members and their families in an Appropriations Act where Congress itself has said that funds can't be redirected, and in the wake of the administration having asked Congress for full funding for a wall, a transcontinental wall, and having been denied that by Congress. So our focus is a little bit different. Judge Briones practiced the wise doctrine of constitutional avoidance and noted that he didn't have to reach a whole bunch of the issues because the violation of the CAA, the Consolidated Appropriations Act, was so clear that he ruled on that basis. So that, along with standing, is what distinguishes us, and we're hopeful. I mean, there's never a guarantee in any case like this. The Supreme Court is always resistant in matters that where there are interbranch conflicts. We'll see what happens. But we're standing under the umbrella that Justice Jackson described in the steel seizure case, Youngstown Sheet and Tube. And we believe if anybody's presented a good case to challenge administration action, it's us.
Now, Judge Briones didn't craft an injunction, right? He gave the plaintiffs 10 days to submit specifics. He gave the government 5 days to respond. I think we're still in that window. Correct me if I'm wrong.
But you're correct. We have filed. The plaintiffs have filed. We're seeking injunctive relief that is consistent with the court's order. In other words, no spending on the wall allowed from the couple of provisions that the administration is attempting to use to evade the Consolidated Appropriations Act. We'll hear from the government in a couple of days as to what its response is going to be.
And in your sense so far, has the government been more or less responsive, or are you going to get either a bait and switch or a delay? Or, I mean, do you have some sense that they're going to come back to help craft something that is workable, or is this going to be another sand in the gears moment?
Well, I don't know if it'll be sand in the gears, but I doubt that it's going to be very cooperative either. I mean, it hasn't been up to now, and I don't blame the lawyers in the federal programs branch of the civil division. They're doing what they're being instructed to do, but it's clear that it's the will of the chief executive to take a hardline position. I imagine what the government is going to come back and say is, we know that we're going to get injunctive relief. I mean, all the court has asked us to do is, mm-hmm. is tell us what it is that we think we ought to get and give the government the chance to respond. I think the government will argue, among other things, that the injunction that we're seeking is too broad, that it constitutes a nationwide injunction. But I think that will miss the point, because this isn't a question of geography. This is a question of spending Congress's budgetary responsibilities, its power of the purse. And if indeed the attempt to use various military appropriation statutes to siphon money out of the place where Congress intended it to go, if it's illegal in one place, it's illegal every place, just as a matter of logic and law. So there'll no doubt be a debate about that, but I really do think we have the better of it.
It's interesting because you mentioned this about the Ninth Circuit, but when Trump was sued, he said, we're going to be very successful. I think we might do very well, even in the Ninth Circuit. It's an open and closed case. Again, part of a long pattern of delegitimizing the Ninth. But you filed the Fifth Circuit is notoriously conservative. Do you have any worries that you're looking down the barrel of an appellate court that is pretty fond of Donald Trump, or at least more inclined to say the kinds of executive powers that he's asserting are palatable for the judiciary?
That may or may not be the case, but I'll tell you why we're in the Fifth Circuit. I wasn't the only one who advocated being there. But speaking for myself, it has always been my view that you try a case in the place that is most affected by it, with a client that really has an interest. In the Kennedy administration, the civil rights cases were brought in the Deep South, in the places where the action was taking place and where it mattered. The Constitution in criminal cases, of course, the framers had in mind that criminal defendants would be tried by their peers where they lived. And I feel much the same way about that in every case. I'm happy to litigate at the center of things, in the eye of the storm. Now, that's one reason why we're there. I mean, we have a client who's there. It's the client's home ground. It's territory. It's defending itself. It's community values in its home. But in addition to that, I'm not pessimistic about the Fifth Circuit either. We're making a very conservative argument. This is not about what our immigration policy ought to be. We ought to have a better immigration policy, but that'll be for the Congress to decide, and it will probably carry over into the election. This has to do with the structural Constitution. And if you follow things that many of us have done with organizations like the Federalist Society, things that we're talking about, carrying out the framers' intent, being faithful to the Constitution as it is, not dealing with a constitution that we don't have, one that arguably assigns rights and benefits. That's not our constitution. Our constitution is one that recognized in overthrowing the rule of a king that we'd better divide government in several ways. First, have powers that are retained by the states. That's not an issue here. But within the federal government, to deal with questions of factions, as Madison pointed out, to deal with the issues of preventing the restoration or the reestablishment of a king, that powers should be separated among three branches. Checks and balances is the slogan by which that has become known. But I'm one who, in the first Bush administration, argued for a virtually unlimited war power that the president has, and I still believe that. But when I say virtually unlimited, there is one limitation, and that's the Article I power of Congress to appropriate and spend money. Here is a case where the executive is arrogating a legislative power to itself. That's something that a conservative court ought to understand. I know several of the conservative judges on the Fifth Circuit quite well, and I feel comfortable in our making that argument to them.
It's a new year, but it's the same old, no law, just vibe Supreme Court. I'm Melissa Murray.
I'm Leah Littman.
I'm Kate Shaw. And we are the hosts of the Strict Scrutiny podcast on Crooked Media, who also happen to be constitutional law professors in our free time.
Join us each week as we unpack what's on the docket for the Supreme Court term and break down the latest headlines while still managing a laugh or two.
So whether you're a lawyer, a law student, or just trying to make sense of what these cases mean,
Strict Scrutiny has got you covered.
New episodes out every Monday, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's time for some bad decisions.
Friends, I am so excited to announce that I'll be in Miami on November 13th, and I hope to see many of you there. We are teaming up with the Miami Book Fair and the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press for a very, very special Amicus Live show. I'll be joined by an all-star panel of fantastic female journalists, Laura Moscoso from the Centro di Periodismo, Nora Gámez-Torres for El Nuevo Herald, and Emily Michaud of the Miami Herald. Tickets to the show are free. For more information and tickets, visit slate.com/live. Hope to see you there. Let's now return to my conversation with Stuart Gerson. One of the things that I've been thinking about, you know, I've been watching the different sort of prominent, I know you are one of the sort of founding members of Checks and Balances, is that you're all self-sorting, kind of picking a lane. I think George Conway has very much taken it upon himself to think about the president's mental fitness. He's written extensively about that. Paul Rosenzweig has picked another route. And you have really, I think it seems to me, been laser focused on very structural arguments like the one you just laid out about the boundaries between the president's power and congressional power. And I wonder, I mean, I think it's a lane, in some ways, it's so abstract, Stuart, and the arguments that you're making are both incredibly compelling to somebody who went to law school, and yet I think it's very, very ephemeral to somebody who just buys into the idea that, you know, Donald Trump can do whatever he wants because he's the president, and, you know, whatever valence you want to put on it, that his executive power is king-like. And I wonder how you I almost want you to concretize what you're saying and help folks who are struggling to understand. It's very, very clear when George Conway writes about narcissistic personality disorder, what he's trying to do. Can you explain in a very, very concrete way for folks who haven't thought about it as cerebrally as you're describing, what it is that you feel is at risk?
Well, let me deal with that on two levels. First, in the base level that you describe, I'm doing exactly what you're suggesting. I'm speaking to people who have gone to law school or who have studied policy, political science majors and whatever. It's not just to intelligent people, but it's to educated people who can act on this and do something about it. It's in parallel to other arguments. At the same time, I'm a party to letters that deal with the president's toleration, indeed encouragement of racism, of ethnic stereotyping, of violating the rule of law in a bunch of concrete ways. So we're all doing these different things. The so-called cerebral arguments that I'm making are indeed targeted to perhaps a narrower audience than things that my friend George has been doing. But that aside, if you're asking me, let me synthesize this for the mass public who might not have taken as much civics as others and hasn't studied the Constitution and some of these somewhat technical issues that I'm describing about and doesn't bridle when they hear a president say that Article 2 allows me to do anything I want. This is the second one. Nixon said that too. Here's the issue. And it's the issue for people, ordinary people who are concerned about gun rights and a whole host of other issues. What were the framers getting at when they put a Second Amendment in the Constitution, when they separated powers, and when we had our first president, George Washington, refused to be crowned a king, which was offered to him several times. And I'm now talking to the guy in West Virginia, perhaps, who's concerned about his job future and the like of that. I mean, the response is you're never going to get a good deal. You're going to be a serf. You're going to be subjugated forever if we trend towards an authoritarian government. We want a government of the people. And that's what the framers had in mind. And it really matters. It's not just an abstraction. We don't want a government that tells us what the truth is when the facts are decidedly different. We don't want to have a government that in the name of promoting the economic well-being of its people sponsors anti-trade policies that then require subsidies within the government that could better go to things that actually would help people. This ultimately is a bread and butter issue. Yeah, there's an abstraction in between it, but we're trying to avoid dictatorship. That's not an abstraction. That's my answer to you. This ought to matter. We need a better informed public. There's no question about it. But as I'm looking at the polling data that I'm seeing, the public is becoming better and better informed. What we hope for on the conservative side is that by election time, there are rational choices to make, that we haven't swung too far to the left with untenable policies that involve the government in economic control and other matters that can be just as dangerous. There's too much of the electorate, perhaps a majority of the electorate, both to the left and right of center, that is unrepresented now. While I condemn the executive in many ways, it's also true that Congress isn't doing its job. That the Republicans in the Senate are viewing themselves as a parliamentary party. That's not what they're supposed to be. They're not electing the president. They're representing their constituents. The House, the same way. We just need a more productive legislature. As unpopular as the president might be, the Congress is at least as unpopular. There's a reason for that. Paying attention to the Constitution is a way to come out from under that rock. And ultimately, the responsibility lays with the people. I mean, when the Constitutional Convention presented the Constitution, Benjamin Franklin was asked what he thought, what had happened, and he said, "We've given you a Constitution and a Republic if you can keep it." And we're being challenged as never before in that area. This is just such an unusual administration. I hope that people understand that and it matters to them. Their problems are not being solved. They should know that. And there's a reason why.
So I had Larry Tribe on the last show, and he made two points that I'd like you to respond to, if you would. One was, you know, the litigation just is too slow. All these cases are just unspooling. He used the all deliberate speed locution, but this is all happening too slow to check this president. And then I think he braided that into an argument that you and the checks and balances crew have made, which is that's why impeachment is the only solution. The courts cannot do this checking. And so I think I want you to respond, Stuart, if you would, to a two-part question, which is big win on the wall. Congratulations. None of this is going to happen fast enough. And relatedly, when you call for an impeachment because it needs to go fast, do you sense that there is enough time for an investigation and a trial to really preempt what I think you and I agree could be catastrophic outcomes Are both these processes, both the litigation strategy and the impeachment that has only really just begun to unspool in an investigation, too slow?
Let's look at it in a different way. Let's step back a little. Sure, litigation is slow, and it's hard to know when one would get an ultimate resolution, for example, of our case, if it goes up to the Supreme Court and it hits there in the summer, especially when they're away and they don't get to it and we roll into the high election season. All these things can happen. But step back from that a second. Think of this as a war. And no successful war on any mass scale can exist without a number of different fronts, a number of different ways to attack the enemy. Here the enemy is an authoritarian, lawless executive. The litigation is part of that. There are various other things, investigations and the like of that. Some of them are within normal process. For example, one of the potentially impeachable offenses has to do with the Ukrainian situation. I'll come to that in a second in the context of impeachment. But at the same time, it's clear that the United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York, that is somebody who's in the Justice Department in this administration, is actively pursuing a criminal investigation, not just against these Tweedledees and Tweedledums who are associates of Mr. Giuliani, but apparently Giuliani himself. So there's another aspect where there are criminal cases, referrals from the Mueller investigation that are in court. Impeachment is a different story. And this is something that I don't think is widely understood. And I certainly hear a lot of ignorance from, sadly, Republican critics of what is going on in the House with regard to the investigation. With regard to some of this conduct, they're saying, well, this or that isn't a crime. And so it can't be prosecuted. And so there's a question of the Justice Department's memorandum about prosecution, more to come on that. But the framers understood that, too. And that's what high crimes and misdemeanors are about. You alluded to that earlier. High crimes and misdemeanors are not infractions that are prosecuted under the criminal law. It's conduct that's inconsistent with the responsibilities of the office, abuses of power. And there, the House is well within its prerogatives to have an investigation. The Justice Department's memorandum, the ultimate conclusion of which I agree with, by the way, having to do with whether a president can be tried in a case while he's in office, I think is correct. But the memorandum itself states that the president can be investigated, and indeed it suggests that he can even be indicted, just can't be tried while he's in office. And so the framers very well understood this sequential matter of impeach, and then the various jurisdictions could get their cases actually heard, if indeed they were there. So to go back to your original question, there are a number of fronts here. Ultimately, it may be that there'll be a political solution to it. Even if Trump were reelected, I mean, recall 1968 when Nixon was reelected by a vast majority. And yet, once essentially a lame duck, the fear went out of him and Republicans stepped up to the plate, indeed led the action. Howard Baker was a Republican, and certainly no one was more responsible for the bill of impeachment that was prepared and ultimately the president's resignation. So who knows what the time frame will be? Larry Tribe is correct that litigation is slow. It's only one aspect of this. We're pursuing it because we believe that we're right. He does too, obviously. He's involved in the case. Ultimately, the responsibility here is going to lay with the people, both at the polls and in informing their legislators now of what they think is in their best political interest.
I think you just said the single most important thing that I've noted this week, which is we're starting to map this no quid pro quo language onto this there was no crime language. And where Matt Whitaker said it this week, it's become the line of defense. A lot of Republicans in the Senate are saying no crime. And I just want to reference, you wrote an article in July in The Atlantic arguing for seeing more of the Mueller report and knowing more about the obstruction allegations there. But you made this argument. I want to quote it to you. Quote, this has been framed as a question of collusion. Collusion is not a term term employed in federal criminal law, and the fixation on it has been a diversion, end quote. I wonder if you just respond to my sense that, quote, no quid pro quo has become the new no collusion. It's something that is being imported from the criminal law into an impeachment inquiry that, as you just ably pointed out, has nothing to do with federal statutory crimes necessarily. Abuse of power is not a crime, says the defense here, but we're not looking for crimes. And I just wonder if you think that we're being jujitsued in some sense yet again by claims that if there's no quid pro quo in the conversation around Ukraine, then this whole thing goes away. Can you respond to my sense that no quid pro quo is being deployed in exactly the way no collusion once was?
It is. I mean, your summary is correct, but there's a fundamental problem with it that transcends this argument. And that is, it's pretty clear there was a quid pro quo and that there were crimes. And let me tell you what I, at least probable cause to believe that there were. I mean, I think everybody's entitled to a trial ultimately. And the president, if impeached, will get one. And if not, and out of office and is indicted, will get a trial. But here's the issue. I mean, I think in the interviews that have been leaked this week, but in the transcript of the call itself, it is very clear that it was transmitted to the leader of the Ukraine, both by the president and otherwise by agents of the president, that military aid was going to be withheld unless an investigation was undertaken into the president's political opponents. That's a quid pro quo. Now, what does that mean, besides the fact that it arguably is an impeachable offense? But if proved, it shows that the president has received an emolument, because that's something of value, which the Emoluments Clause speaks about. It's a violation of the federal election campaign law, because something of value has been received that is of benefit to the campaign but is unreported. And so those are criminal matters. Now, whether they're ultimately provable, that goes way beyond this conflation of no quid pro quo and no criminal offense. That's wrong, too. But you're right that the fundamental issue that the Congress is considering is an abuse of power, whether the president's provable actions, whether there's probable cause to believe that the president's provable actions violate the Take Care Clause of the Constitution, violate the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, and violate the president's oath of office to see that the laws of the nation are carried out.
And before we leave impeachment, Stuart, I wonder if you could talk for a moment about the other line of attack, which seems to be that this impeachment effort is unfair because it's, you know, not affording the president due process, because it hasn't yet turned into a formal vote proceeding with impeachment, barring everything we know about how the Starr report triggered impeachment against Bill Clinton. But I wonder if your sense is that all of these process arguments about how the process isn't fair to the president are rooted in something that is, there's some principle here that is compelling and interesting, or if this is kind of more of what I've characterized as sand in the gears.
These are the same kinds of arguments that many Democrats were making when the Clinton impeachment process was underway. And to step back from that, it's an argument that's directed to people who watch a lot of television and who watch crime shows. It ought to be explained, and I'll explain now, as my colleague Charles Fried did very persuasively in a very fine letter that he wrote to the Washington Post in the wake of that unfortunate Cipollone letter, which really is a screed that has very little to do with the law. But the framers understood this. And the way the law is carried out and the way the constitutional provision are carried out is much the same as I think you pointed out earlier, as there was a long history of in English law, going back hundreds of years before the creation of the American Republic. The House of Representatives was intended to act like a grand jury. Now, crime shows on TV don't show grand juries. Law and Order doesn't deal with grand juries. They just deal with trials where you get due process. but in a grand jury proceeding in law, state law and federal law, you don't get access to materials. You don't get to sit in with the grand jury. You don't get to cross-examine witnesses. The grand jury is a fact-finding body that brings charges if it thinks charges are merited. It's at the trial stage where you have the right of confrontation, where you have the right to introduce evidence, to call witnesses of your own, to get the kind of process that supporters of the president are yelling about. It's a dual process. It parallels what actually exists in federal criminal law. But you don't look at the House as a thing unto itself, as a completed matter. All the House does is, if it chooses to do so, to bring charges under which a president will be tried. It's up to the Senate to decide to sit as a jury, if you will, under the command of the Chief Justice, who presides over the impeachment trial. And there's where due process obtains. That's well understood. It's this bipartite process, the House serving as a grand jury, the Senate serving as a trial court, that people need to understand and know about. The argument that's being made about due process is a diversion. It was a diversion when it was made by Democrats. It's a diversion when it's being made by Republicans now.
I think we have to turn to what I think is the most alarming news that came at the end of the week, which is reporting from NBC that the Attorney General's probe into the origins of the Russia investigation has somehow morphed from a clean administrative review into a criminal investigation. And I think I should be clear that we don't know who has leaked this, and maybe I don't know the contours of how truthful that is. But I find that sort of DEFCON level terrifying. And I wondered if you'd help explain, if that is in fact correct, what that means.
Well, I don't know anything for sure because, like you, I know what I've read in the paper. Either an unauthorized leak or a controlled leak suggests that there's been some escalation in the review of the conduct of the FBI in particular, but other aspects of the government with respect to how this whole thing got going. And I also note that in a brief that has been filed in the last couple of days by General Flynn in the district court, setting forth any number of allegations with respect to the conduct of the FBI and the government with regard to how the investigation began, there's either direct or constructive coordination of arguments. I don't know anything beyond that. The whole thing is very troubling. It will be what it will be. I mean, there's just too much that obtains that we don't know about, but it is also clear to me that there was a substantial basis to undertake an inquiry into the activities of Russia and the intention of the leadership of Russia to manipulate not just election results, but public opinion. Those are facts. And however the investigation started, we now know of things that we really need to know about and react to. You raise an alarm. To me, the alarm would be, however the investigation comes out, and I don't express an opinion about it because I just don't have the factual knowledge to do so, but however that comes about, it should not obscure the fact that there is ample evidence of entirely unacceptable cybersecurity warfare being conducted against the American electoral process and American policy by not only Russia, but other countries as well. I mean, we have to deal with China and state-sponsored organizations, Iran, North Korea, but Russia in particular. And if we lose sight of that, we are in a tremendous trap where responsibility for our government will be seized from our hands and placed in the hands of foreign adversaries. So that, to me, is the alarming issue about this. I don't know where this investigation will go. There certainly was some conduct that I wouldn't approve of, but whether that rises to a criminal level or not, I can't say.
And I just want to read from that the pleading you just referenced in the Michael Flynn case. There is language, just to put meat on the bones here, quote, in this case, high-ranking FBI officials orchestrated an ambush interview of the new president's national security advisor, not for the purpose of discovering any evidence of criminal activity. They already had tapes of all the relevant conversations about which they had questioned Mr. Flynn, but for the purpose of trapping him into making statements they could allege as false, end quote. And the document you're referencing is replete with this language of the real conspiracy, the real crime here is the massive corruption in the department itself and in our national security apparatus. And I think that the point you're making is this feels a lot like the Ukraine ask itself, which is we're going to throw into shadow, you know, that the real corruption that is happening is elsewhere. And the effect here of attacking the Justice Department, attacking investigators, is not simply to try to clear Michael Flynn or to try to clear Rudy Giuliani or the president, but it's to sort of deflect the actual harms here, which are, oh my goodness, this is happening, and to try to inculpate others. But I worry so much about what it means, as you say, in the fact of unequivocal evidence that foreigners are tampering with the next election, that instead throwing dirt around and seeing if you can somehow destabilize the very forces that are meant to protect against that.
I'm not prepared to go quite as far as you are. I'm not going to imply intentionality on the part of Bill Barr and the Justice Department. That will take its own pace, and I don't know what the U.S. attorney in Connecticut who's leading this investigation is going to do. So I won't attribute intentionality to the government. And I'll also note that the arguments that you're describing are made by Michael Flynn to try to get himself exonerated. And this issue of the perjury trap is something that we hear in every single investigation. And in the interests of full disclosure, I'm sure that I've raised it on behalf of clients in the past. So these are Flynn's arguments. I'll just leave it at this. The fundamental point that you're making, and I hope is clear to me, is that whatever is involved in this, it shouldn't be allowed to be a diversion from the fact that there's a real problem here that has nothing to do with it. That we have interference by a foreign power in our public policy, in our elections, and that cannot go unaddressed. That is a fundamental problem that threatens our democracy. If people have to be changed at the FBI or there's some issue there, that's an action that'll take its own course. I can't comment on it. I don't know the evidence. On the other hand, I certainly know what the evidence is about lenience and encouragement, the role of Russia in dealing with questions in the subcontinent, in Turkey, in Syria, and how that seems to have influenced the administration, and how Russia, and not only Russia, attempts to influence American public policy and American election behavior. And however that investigation got started, there's plenty of evidence that we've got a problem that needs to be addressed, and it's a far more important problem than whatever the outcome is of the investigation of how the inquiry got started.
Stuart Gerson served as Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Division of the Justice Department from 1989 to 1993 and as Acting Attorney General for the Clinton administration in 1993. He is a member of the firm of Epstein Becker Green. He is a founding member of Checks and Balances, and he's become a really, I think, singularly important voice in the conservative effort to talk about the need for checks and balances on this executive at this time. Stuart, it is a pleasure to have you back on the show. You're welcome anytime.
Thank you, Dahlia.
Cyrus Habib is the Lieutenant Governor of Washington State, elected in November 2016 at the age of 35. He had previously been elected to the State House of Representatives in 2012 and the State Senate in 2014, where he was Democratic whip and a member of the Democratic leadership team. Since 2019, he served as co-chair of the Democratic Lieutenant Governors Association. A three-time cancer survivor, Lieutenant Governor Habib has been fully blind since age 8. His parents immigrated to the U.S. from Iran before he was born, and he is the first and only Iranian-American to hold statewide elected office in the U.S. Cyrus is a graduate of Columbia University, Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar, and Yale Law School, where he was editor of the Yale Law Journal. He practiced law at Perkins Coie and served as distinguished lawmaker in residence at Seattle University Law School. He is a Truman Scholar, a Soros Fellow, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and has been named a young global leader by the World Economic Forum. It is, I suspect, the most impressive resume on anyone who has ever appeared on this show, but that's not why I wanted to talk to Cyrus. He is also almost freakishly optimistic about the law and the rule of law and the Constitution and civility and the threads that bind us together, even when they feel like they're coming apart. And this show sometimes makes people sad. I felt like I wanted to have Cyrus on to help remind us, and maybe just me, of something that we sometimes forget, which is the law can be and is a powerful and beautiful thing that binds us together and makes us better. Slate Plus members will hear an extended version of this interview. And if you're not a Slate Plus member, stay tuned for details on how you can join our membership program. But now for an interview that I've wanted you to hear for a long time. Cyrus Habib, welcome to Amicus.
I'll be as close to freakishly optimistic as I can be.
So I want you to start by telling us, I think the important thing, at least to sort of locate us in this moment, is that you get elected in the state of Washington on the same day that Donald Trump is elected president of the United States. And I wanted to just sort of start by saying it seems as though these two narratives are hard to hold in our mind, right? On the one hand, you're the kid of Iranian immigrants. You're, blind for much of your life. You are a person who has thought so hard and worked so hard to advance progressive values. Oh, and also we just elected somebody who paid hush money to a porn star. So how do you hold in your mind the ascendancy of both, I think, all that is great about America and opportunity in this country and where we are in terms of this president?
Yeah, I will always treasure the like 45 minutes in between when I found out that I had won and when Pennsylvania came in the night took a decidedly dark turn. But, you know, for me, it was I think to answer your question, I guess I would say that I took a lot of inspiration. I first ran for office in 2012, and I ran and served in the state House and then the state Senate starting in 2014. And I was really motivated by Barack Obama. When I was in law school, I have to admit, I was one of those people who didn't really believe it was possible for someone with that name, with a name that literally rhymes with Iraq, Hussein, Osama, to be the first president elected after the 9/11 presidency of George W. Bush. I guess I wasn't freakishly optimistic at that point. And the fact that he did, and the fact that he won primaries in places that aren't known for being interested in Kenyan ancestry or an Indonesian upbringing in the primary and then in the general was really a source of confidence for me as I went into elected office. But there's no question that when I ran statewide, it posed a different set of challenges than when I just ran for a legislative race, because now all of a sudden you're running not just in the really diverse Seattle suburbs and the city of Seattle, but also in eastern Washington. And I guess what I would say is that by focusing on how my life story, my biography, allows me to connect with everybody, blind and sighted, Iranian American and Irish American, I was able to do really well statewide and not only win, but to win with a really comfortable margin. I think what we need to do throughout the country is put that kind of politics forward. And I think, you know, what we saw, you know, there's a whole bunch of ways to look at the Trump election. And so I don't want to pin it on just one thing. And again, keeping in mind that Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote by millions. But at the same time, I think going forward, we need to recognize that a politics of inclusion, positivity, and abundance can allow if it can allow a blind Iranian American to win statewide, then there's much more that we can do throughout the country.
And so I think hearing you say, and I think you're putting the finger on one of the challenges I even have hosting this show, which is we need to keep talking to each other. We need to keep engaging with each other. And the othering of one another is what's ripping us apart. And at the same time, all the ways that that feels like appeasement and feels like, you know, how many times do we have to concede that, you know, coal miners in West Virginia count? And I think what you're saying, it sounds like something I want to believe. It's a story I want to tell. It also feels like at some point, how much are you giving up sort of the dignity and nobility of your own core values?
But I think our core values are, I mean, if you think about what I said, so I'm talking about inclusion. I'm talking about generosity. I'm talking about positivity. And I think these are our values. So let me give you, I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. We had this challenge when I ran for office, which was that I wear sunglasses. And so we had to explain, why is this guy wearing sunglasses? You can imagine why in the sometimes rainy Pacific Northwest, it's particularly odd to be wearing sunglasses. And so, you know, so we had to explain that I'm blind. But at the same time, we didn't want to come across, you know, like we're pandering. And we also had to, you know, communicate ability and strength, right? So how do we do all these things at the same time? And, you know, my TV commercial is still up on YouTube so people can see it. But I'll tell you from the script, what we said was something like, you know, I lost my eyesight as a child, and that taught me how to listen. So what we did there was we made it very clear that, look, I'm blind. That's who I am. But then rather than saying, and that makes, you know, you privileged as a sighted person and me not privileged, or rather than saying, like, you know, I'm running to advance the cause of people with disabilities, instead what we said was, look, being heard is probably really important to you if you're a voter, whether you've ever met a blind person or not. And here's how my lived experience gives me access to, you know, what you go through. And I think, like, you know, and like another way that I do that is to talk about, I know what it's like to be left out. I remember what it's like to not be allowed to play with my friends on the playground because I'm blind as a kid. I remember what it's like to have people say, well, you know, college isn't for everyone, and try to limit my possibilities. So that allows me some insight into what other folks may feel when they feel excluded. And I think that we need to recognize that every American has felt both privilege at times in their lives and has also felt obstacles. And one of the things I think that sometimes we do on the left is we don't like it, understandably, when people call us snowflakes, but then we revel in referring to, quote, white fragility and discounting the fragility of our counterparts or our interlocutors across the aisle. And I think we can proceed in a much more generous and understanding way by recognizing that we've all felt exclusion at some point or another, and we've all sometimes felt that we're not being heard.
I love what you're saying, because it actually clarifies for me why some of the language, even words like mansplaining, which have some utility, but I think they're silencing tropes that we use on the left when any man starts to talk. And I like what you're saying, because you're saying, first and foremost, and maybe this dovetails with so many things we talk about in terms of the First Amendment, people are talking, everybody is talking, and everybody right now, that we're weaponizing the First Amendment, so all speech is vital, but nobody's listening, and that it's the corollary, right? You need the second without the first, and any language of silencing is not going to get us there.
Yeah, and I also think that, look, you know, I, as you mentioned, I studied in England. I went to Oxford for graduate school, and I remember when I went there, you know, it's like they filmed Harry Potter there. Like, you know, the dining hall is like quite formal, and there's all these kind of rituals and things. And there's, I remember the first time I ate in at the high table, and there were, like, you know, 5 forks and 6 knives and a bunch of spoons, and it was like very, you know, kind of intimidating. And to me, what that represented was etiquette that serves as a kind of a socioeconomic signal, right? Like if you know what fork to use, if you know what spoon to use, like you're signaling that you're in the in-group and you've obtained a certain social class. I think that right now, sometimes what we do when we use certain types of terms or judge others for not being up on the most woke vocabulary is, you know, we're signaling to others at a meeting or a conference or at our workplace or in our schools that, like, you know, we get it. We're on the inside. You know, we speak this kind of rarefied language, and that if you don't, then you're not, you know, there's something kind of lesser about it. And look, people come back and say, this is just white fragility or this is whatever. But I think the point is, do we want to have as large a coalition of support as possible or not? Do we want to turn people off who are of goodwill and want to work with us towards a more equitable society? Or do we want to insist on certain coded language and gestures as a way of kind of indicating social hierarchies? And I think that's a real concern of mine as we go into the 2020 election.
That was Cyrus Habib, Lieutenant Governor of Washington State and the first Iranian-American elected to statewide office in the U.S. He's been blind since age 8. He's a Rhodes Scholar and graduate of Yale Law School. He has a lot more to say about the state of politics and our own humanity. Plus, members have access to the extended version of this interview in which Cyrus talks me through his early life, losing his sight, the inspiration he's taken from his mother, who started law school the day he started kindergarten, and who advocated for her son tirelessly when he needed it most. It is a heartwarming and inspiring and thoroughly thought-provoking interview. If you're not a Plus member yet, you can access the interview and a whole host of bonus content from your very favorite Slate shows, and you can enjoy all those shows ad-free by signing up for Slate Plus. Here's how you do it. Only $35 for your first year, and you can sign up free for 2 weeks to check it out. By signing up for Slate Plus, of course, you'll be supporting this show, all the journalism we do here at Slate. We know you value our coverage. We hear it every day. And you know how urgent the work is, so we just need your help to do it. Sign up for Slate Plus and help secure Slate's future. To learn more and to begin your free 2-week trial, go to slate.com/amicusplus. And that's a wrap for this episode of Amicus. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to get in touch, our email, as always, is amicus@slate.com. And you can find us at facebook.com/amicuspodcast. We are finding your letters inspiring new shows, and that's really helpful. So thank you. Today's show was produced by Sarah Birmingham. Gabriel Roth is editorial director of Slate Podcasts. June Thomas is senior managing producer of Slate Podcasts. We will be back with another episode of Amicus in 2 short weeks.